What is missing in the Catholic Church in the past 50 to 100 years that has led to decline? In fact, we could say it's been missing in the West, even missing in humanity. And the answer to that question is virtue. Virtue are the habits, the patterns in your life, in the life of everyone around us that makes us not only good and great, but happy. I'm here with Tim Gordon. He studied this in his dissertation work. I studied this in my dissertation work. And we are passionate about the virtues in Aristotle and in Thomas Aquinas. And we're passionate about it because it changes our life, and it will change your life too, because you'll understand this is why I'm acting this way, and this is how I change and become great. Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about Aristotle. You're going to handle Aristotle today. I'm going to handle Thomas Aquinas, and we're going to talk about this important, forgotten method of thinking and acting, and that is virtue.
Crucial to the life of everyone. Note what you said, Dr. Marshall. I'll be covering the great of all time, the GOAT, the great pre-Christian scholar. Yeah. Greatest of all time. You're covering the GOAT, greatest of all time, post-Christian scholar. And the reason they're so close together, one is there's an influence the former has on the latter, but two, they're like the two smartest guys ever, says I. And they understand how crucial the big, you know, heady concepts like metaphysics, and Thomas makes metaphysics about soteriology, all this heady stuff. They understand how important that is. They also understand at what they consider to be the bottom end of the spectrum, day-to-day life, how virtue is the center to people's happiness. It's also why a pre-Christian who doesn't have the grace of our Lord, the graces of the sacrament, the graces of soteriology or the cross, Aristotle has none of that. We call him the blessed pagan because he understood natural virtue so very well. And the center to everyone's happiness, Aristotle called it eudaimonia, is virtue, is natural moral virtue. So everyone's accountable for it. Everyone's responsible for it. Pre-Christians, post-Christians, people that have never heard the word Jesus. It's centrally important. And people will understand why if they begin reading the ethics or they just watch this podcast all the way through. Why would it still sounds philosophical to people who haven't studied this? Why did Aristotle and Thomas consider it important but unglamorous compared to the metaphysics? Because they're talking about things like habit and why habit is at the beating heart of the virtues, why the golden mean is the way that the virtues work. So we'll talk some about that. It's really, really easy to digest stuff. I've been teaching it to seniors in high school the last 3 years. People didn't think I'd be able to do it because it's Aristotle, but it's eminently doable. And it's also eminently important, like you already said. Now, you have a lot of stuff on this with the new St. Thomas Institute, but what most specifically keys in? I know there's a lot.
So we're going to talk about the four cardinal virtues primarily today, but if you like this, go to my institute, New St. Thomas Institute, newstthomas.com, and we have an entire curriculum, a certificate called Catholic Philosophy and Thomistic Studies. And in there, we talk about the 11 passions of your soul, how your soul works with the will, the intellect, and the 11 passions. We talk about the cardinal virtues, the theological virtues, all of this basic Catholic philosophy. And I don't want you guys to glaze over and say, oh, I don't need to learn philosophy. I'm just going to pray the rosary. Yes, pray the rosary. But this stuff is not beyond your grasp. You can do this. So right. A free resource would be go to my website, taylormarshall.com, and I have a book called Thomas Aquinas in 50 Pages. Get that book for free, and there's a glossary in the back that gives you keywords. This book has been – over 100,000 people have used this book. It's very basic. You don't even need a bachelor's degree to understand it. Get it and learn the vocabulary, learn the philosophy. And then if you want to go to the next level, go to newstthomas.com and take our curriculum, which will only take you a few weeks, maybe a month. Our curriculum in Catholic philosophy and Thomistic studies. So today we're going to get into that, kind of an intro, and we're going to talk about the virtues. Now, the first thing we got to focus on is what is a virtue? And Tim kind of already said it. A virtue is a habit. It can be, if it's a good virtue, if it's a good habit, we call it a virtue. If it's a bad habit, we call it a vice.
Right.
And a virtue is not like, oh, I helped a lady, old lady cross the street. I'm a virtuous person. No, if you help a lady cross the street 100 times and it's habitual, you now have a virtue. If you have a, you know, if you make a good decision once, that's not virtuous. If you do it 500 times, you have the virtue of prudence. So it's the repeated pattern in our lives. And this is unique to Catholic theology. We focus on the repetition and the transformation of the person, not just a singular act.
Tim. Here's why. So book one of the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle says virtue, like you said, is not an act, but a habit. Here's why people have to understand this. There are two parts to the human soul that aren't in that, that are immortal, right? That aren't in the animal soul, the intellect and the will.
And that's what we call the imago Dei, the image of God, the intellect and the will. Your dog has passions, but he doesn't have an intellectual will to nap. Right. That.
He's got a vegetative soul. He's got an appetitive soul. He appetites for things, but no. The free will is rendered free by the intellect. So these two work together. Now, when you're in a state of vice, right, which all of us are in, we incline toward more naturally in medias res. If you just pick any person's life and start a movie about him on whatever day, random day, we're all inclined toward vice after the fall of Adam and Eve. Whereas we were, that's called concupiscence. We are more virtuous than vicious before the fall. Now it's the other way around. So if you take anybody on any random day that's not laboring actively to become more virtuous, right, they will be in a state where they're ruled by their will, right, not by their intellect. So take, again, take the idea of you realize on December 31st you've eaten too many holiday foods, you're out of shape, and What you're not knowing, if you haven't studied Aristotle, is that your intellect and your will, the two uniquely human aspects of the soul, are misaligned. Like, specifically, you're being ruled by your will. If you just set down 3 pizzas before pretty much anyone, I love pizza, right? They'll keep eating and eating and eating. It's the intellect that says, now, this is probably not a proper amount, and this is what's happened to anyone. So when you say, okay, New Year's resolution, starting tomorrow, I'm going to do a daily run. It's your intellect that is trying to take back over and to tell your will, this is why you have to get off the couch and start running. So the first day you do it, as everyone knows, this is pretty much all of Aristotle's system. The first day you do it, your will revolt, right? You hate it. Your body hurts. You hate every minute of it. The second day you do it, it'll hate it, but it'll hate it a little bit less. The key to understanding Aristotle is that what's happening, as long as your will follow your intellect at the beginning, at least enough to keep doing it, you don't have the virtue yet, because a virtue is not an act, but a habit. And if you do it enough days, you're actually, your intellect is molding your will via habit, and you're getting better at it every day. And that virtue, which, what do you call a virtue just done once? It's called accidental virtue, right? It's not an act, because virtue is just a Greek concept. It's just an individual excellence. There are many virtues. And so you're just working on the virtue of, say, fitness, running specific fitness that day. So you do it once. That is what we'd call an accidental virtue, but it's very accidental. Why? The test is whether you enjoy the virtue after you've done it and as you're doing it. You don't at all. You hate it. But let's say you keep up that run for 3 months, right? Do it about 90, like we just were finishing Exodus 90, 90 or 100 times. They say this is about the amount of time it takes to develop a good habit. After that, come March, as long as your will followed your intellect enough to stick with it, even if you openly hated it in day one, day two, day three, by the time you've done it 90 times, you get your runner's high, your form is better, right? Aristotle says you can measure true virtue by, are you doing the right thing at the right time in the right manner, the way that the just man would do it, the way that the virtuous man would. Your form's perfect. You miss it. If you get sick and you miss a day, you're like, I don't feel right today. I'm bored.
I got to run.
I got to run. That is Aristotle in however long I just took to say it. That's the whole first half of the ethics where he explains how it works.
And what's we know that about running. We know that about diet. Everyone knows, okay, January 1st, I'm going to stop eating carbs. And then 8 days in, they eat ice cream.
Right.
And what happens is over time, like you said, Aristotle says, everybody says, the intellect begins to mold the wills. And those passions, like you mentioned concupiscence, we have 11 passions, according to Thomas Aquinas. Love, hate, desire, aversion, joy, sadness, hope, despair, fear, daring, and anger. Those are just bubbling around. Just think of them down in your guts. And they are trying to take over the kingdom. It is a mutiny. And whenever you allow them to do that, they get stronger and your intellect gets weaker. So it's a battle. And the more your intellect rules the ship, the stronger you are. And it's not just true in running. It has to do with pornography. It has to do with being kind as a parent. It has to do with study and homework. Every area of your life runs on this principle. And this is what Tim and I are saying. This has been lost in the past 50 to 100 years. Bless you. People have not been taught that. We used to be taught this from childhood. Now we are taught either nothing at all or just say a prayer and it will fix it. Well, there has to be a habituation involved in it or you are going to lose the battle. Whether it's moral, let's say pornography, or whether it's just being a great mother or husband or worker, priest, habituation.
Right. Right. Think about the pseudo-piety involved by this all too often heard comment nowadays in the sort of post-Aristotomist crisis time of the church when people are like, no, you might like to study and to talk about virtue and things like that, but I just say a prayer. Why is this so unchristian, even anti-Christian? Because Christianity, unlike as the true religion, the one true faith, unlike the other false faiths, which are full of all kinds of airy platitudes, like just like that, mysticism. There's proper mysticism, but this is an instance of bad mysticism. They repudiate all that remains here below with us. And our faith is Aristotelian precisely because Aristotle and Catholicism, this is something Aristotle happened to luck into, get right, embraced both the material, the bodily, and the formal, right? The formal, of course, is hierarchically has primacy, but except our material lives matter. What we do, our material, what we choose to do in terms of the individual virtues or excellences, they actually mold our character in a way that matters as well. It's not all just about fasting and prayer, right? These might be the top ways to get the virtue of religion, but the individual virtues of, even courage. Courage matters. Aristotle, it's one of the first virtues he talks about. And courage is also, by the way, the best way to introduce the concept to people that virtue is not an extreme and it's not an opposite of vice. It's what Aristotle calls a contrary of vice because it's in the middle on a spectrum. So say courage, Aristotle identifies, as he does for all of the individual virtues, is between a deficiency and an excess, always. And it's what he calls the golden mean. So courage is the midpoint between total deficiency of thereof, like cowardice, right, which we more commonly identify as its opposite, and too much of it, which he calls rashness. He says courage is when you know to stand and fight, and you'll exhibit the proper middling amount in the way that the courageous man would. So you'll stand and fight one man. You don't have to stand and rush headlong into battle against 15 soldiers. That's rashness. And this is all the virtues, right? And they matter in a uniquely human way. The animals cannot get these virtues, the moral virtues anyway. And they matter because they are what we're designed to do, right? We are designed to become excellent. We were given an intellect in fact, so that it could mold our wills in this more perfect image of God. I mean, we're created in the image of God, but it makes us more like God when we become more virtuous. And really, so it's Protestantism that began stripping at this, because what is
the Luther, sound like? Luther hated ethics. He hated virtue ethics.
He called Aristotle the buffoon who ruined Christianity.
Right.
And it's kind of clear to see why, because it all sounds a little bit like Pelagianism, like the idea that we can build our own stairway to heaven when you take it out of context.
Right.
But really all Aristotle's saying is that our day-to-day lives do matter, which Protestantism by and large rejects.
Yes. And, you know, going back to Luther, the four, which, first of all, what are the virtues? Okay, so there's four moral or cardinal virtues. Cardinal just means a hinge, like our lives hinge on these virtues. There are four cardinal or natural virtues, and then there are three supernatural virtues. The three supernatural virtues we find in St. Paul: faith, hope, charity. Faith, hope, love. This is all Baltimore Catechism stuff, man. But we've lost it, Tim. We have lost this bedrock. Then the four cardinal virtues. This is how I teach them to students at high school, college, and the New St. Thomas Institute. Peanut butter, jelly, French toast. PJFT, prudence, justice, fortitude, temperance. It sounds stupid, but if you just remember peanut butter, jelly, French toast, you will never forget them. Prudence, justice, fortitude, temperance. These are actually found in the Bible. Do you know that, Tim?
Not specifically.
It's in a book of the Bible that Martin Luther cut out of the Bible. And that is the Book of Wisdom. So you remember Martin Luther? He removed seven Old Testament books, the Deuterocanonicals. One of the books that he removed is called The Wisdom of Solomon. Chapter 8, verse 7 says, wisdom teaches temperance, prudence, and justice, and fortitude, which are such things as men can have nothing more profitable in life. So what we're talking about, what Tim and I are talking about today, goes back to the Old Testament. It's not something just Greek or just Aristotelian. It's Jewish. It's Hebraic. It's biblical.
Which is the key to Aristotle all the time anyway. Remember, he lives 350 years before Jesus. We should talk about his historical situatedness for a second, and even the form of the natural law that came down to him in the tragedians real fast. But think for a moment, he's living 350, 370 years before Jesus. The only form of extant monotheism in the history of the world is Judaism at that point. The two latter monotheism, there are only three of them. You always say this to atheists, there are 10,000 religions. Well, yeah, but all of them except three are polytheistic and so obvious write-offs, right? This is what I say every time I debate an atheist. But there was only one at that time. This is pre-Christian by just a couple centuries. And so Aristotle not only reasoned his way basically to the idea without being a Jew, without really much contact with Judaism at all, or any to speak of, he reasoned his way to monotheism in a very Judeo-Christian way. He reasoned his way to the, not quite the connection between ethics and metaphysics, but at least the ideas of ethics, arguably better than the Jews without supernatural revelation of the Old Testament. So he's very, very, very prescient, precocious, smart for a pagan. And that's the essence of what the natural law and the natural reason can do in its superlative form, Aristotle's brain. Now, if we had it, you know, in a preserved somewhere in Greece, this should be studied, because Aristotle's brain is one of the greatest things ever created, even though it's pagan. So what came down to Aristotle, since we're going back a little bit further than even Aristotle now, is the what's called the tragic period of ancient Greece. You go back a little before that, and it's called the Homeric or Hesiodic period of Greece, you know, when really the stuff of the myths is being first told by Homer and Hesiod. And that's like, you know, 800, 1,000 years before Jesus. But between 800 and 400, when Plato and Aristotle kind of took over BC, is what we call the tragic period, more like 700 to 500. And the great Greek tragedians were really the first ones to ever record the oral tradition of the natural law, which in its first well-expressed form comes to us in book five of Aristotle's Ethics. But the natural law is the capture within nature of God's laws as moral laws, as he created and as he intended them to be, which is to say universal, which is why you don't get to say I can murder, I'm off the hook, because I'm not a Christian. That was before I was Christian. It's like, no, you know the basic stuff, even as a pre-Christian. So the three tragedians that come down to us, Sophocles, Euripides, and Aeschylus, it's amazing, amazing stuff. And really, study of these three tragedians like constitutes a good education, you know, when you're in middle school, early high school.
Which is another thing that has been lost.
Absolutely.
Like, listen, everybody out there, we have to wake up. We have been robbed. You know, if you are under the age of 70 years old, you have been robbed. You did not receive training in logic. You were never taught how to think formally, most of us. You did not learn Greek tragedy. You did not learn Homer. You did not learn later Virgil. You didn't read Cicero. You didn't learn Aristotle. All of this, you were ripped off. And you need to be a little upset about it. Because the way of thinking and the way of becoming great was taken away. And we need to restore it. So it's not just enough to say we need to go back to traditional liturgy. We need to go back to traditional theology, traditional seminary training. Look, what we are stating right here is, this is like an even bigger red pill. What we were taught on how to be human and think and act has been lost for decades.
Right.
We are in Mordor, you know?
Right.
We're in big trouble.
Right. Like what Dr. Marshall means is, well, I studied literature. I studied it at a Catholic school in the 70s or 80s. It's like, you weren't studying literature. You were studying smut garbage that someone wrote in the last century or two. That's not literature. Literature is what we used to call philology, right? The classics, right? Yeah. All those thinkers he was just talking about, and many, many, many more. The late Greeks and early Romans who wrote pure genius. And again, we're not even just talking about Christians. You have to ask yourself why. At some point, if you want to interrogate the claim that he just made or even challenge it, okay, why were all these pagans so important to a Catholic education from the time of Augustine, St. Augustine, through Thomas, up to, I don't know, whatever Pope Leo XIII was educated on, almost in our
Pretty
time.
Pretty much up to 1900.
Right. Up to 1900, say. Let's use that as the dead date. Why were they all studying Ovid, Virgil, you know, Aeschylus, Herodotus, and then Euripides and Sophocles too? Why were they all doing that? None of those, I don't think any of those guys were Christians. So why? You know, Cicero, why were they studying these Stoics and priests?
These were even the lower classes. Like Shakespeare in his plays is making constant reference to all of this. And the people off the street in London know it and get it and laugh and understand it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So what you and I were talking about before, it was just, we made a random poll. The natural law is sort of it's the provocative answer to the rhetorical question you or I just asked. We're kind of both asking. And it's the real answer. It's very rare that something is both the rhetorical provocative answer and the true answer. The natural law is what enables all of us to kind of figure things out, right? Our natural reason in conjunction with the natural law.
To a certain level.
Of course.
You're not going to sit around on an island and come up with the Trinity and the Nicene Creed and the Incarnation.
Or understand how, you know, transubstantiation works. No. Right. With natural truths, some of which are very deep, even deeper than just how to habituate running and fitness. Some of them go deeper, but none of them go as deep as the transubstantiation. Why? Because God created nature that way. That's what you have to tell your Protestant friends. That's what you now have to tell your Catholic friends. God wanted it this way, the Creator. He wanted to create a creation that was moral, intelligible, and goal-driven. And this is how I always, these three prongs are what the natural law is. They were available to Aristotle before the Christian era. Aristotle and Plato brought a new era to Greece. Before him brought the tragedians like Sophocles, right? We're going to talk about Sophocles in a half a minute. Like Homer, even Homer, really the first sort of Greek writer that gave them mythology, understood aspects of the natural law because it was intended by the Lord, the creation itself, that is, to be moral. It's the most important thing in human life, in human happiness and thriving, is being moral. It was intended to be intelligible to all, not just converted Christians, not just the nation of Israel in the Old Testament. Even the, you know, even those outside the 12 tribes were accountable for the natural law. And there is a goal to it. Those are the three prongs, the way I always break down the natural law. Now, take Sophocles. There's this famous tragedy by Sophocles called the Antigone. And it's about this character, Antigone, who is caught between the positive law, the laws of her country, and the natural law, the laws required by the gods, right? The heavens, the higher law.
Yeah, we would say like natural civil law, and then, a civil law and a natural law. That's how
right.
most people
right.
out there would think of it. And a common example would be in America, the civil law says you can have an abortion. It's legal, no punishment. But the natural law says you cannot murder your baby in the womb. So we have right. a disconnect. That's just a very one that everyone can recognize right away, that there are disconnects between the natural law, which is always right, and the civil law, which is sometimes right, sometimes wrong. And this play by Sophocles, Antigone, is really a drama playing off that tension.
Right. Especially when to take it one step and make it even more tragic. The true definition, says the scholar Walter Kaufman, real tragedy is it when your ice cream falls on the floor and it's dirty now and it's got dust all over. Real tragedy is when you, like Antigone, are ordered by the state or by an agent of the state to do something, and you're going to lose your life if you don't do it. That violates the natural law. So positive law and natural law, which are supposed, we're going to talk about this a little in Aristotle, are supposed to work together. They're not exactly the same, but there's supposed to be enough overlap to make the positive law and the natural law work together. Positive law, the laws of the land, should be roughly based on the moral law, even if they're not perfectly moral. But when they go diametrically opposed to one another, then you get any of the Greek tragedies, the Oresti, or in this case, the Antigone. To make your example, Dr. Marshall, even more tragic, it would be like you're ordered by the state to pay taxes which support Planned Parenthood, which has been the case for many of us.
Or in China, you're ordered to have an abortion on the medical table because right. of a one-child policy. You're being ordered.
Right. Right. What do you do? This is true tragedy. It's one of the best things this scholar Walter Kaufman ever said. I don't endorse other things, but I think the real definition of tragedy, the way the Greeks understood it. And this is what came to Plato and Aristotle, the tragedians who wrote things like Oedipus, right? This is a horrible situation to kill your father and to marry your mother and not even to know it. You're going to gouge out your eyes, yeah. Like Oedipus does. I mean, if you wind up with a life this tragic, we all suffer our share of it. Then, yeah, the only thing you could do is gouge out your eyes or worse. But it's only after you go through the tragedy, says, the first of the great tragedians that we only have three remaining to us. That's when you see, you gouge out your eye and then you see, or Sophocles and Aeschylus, the later tragedians, say the same thing. Basically, you go through the tragedy, and that's what makes you uniquely human. Plato and Aristotle take this tragic period of the Greeks. They say there's much beauty. Almost all beauty in human drama comes from suffering. One of the great untold truths in raw American life. It's absolutely true. But they say there is a way to codify it, to sort of untangle the web, to order it a little bit. And the best way to do it, I'm being really generalistic here, is through virtue, right? I mean, the good part about Aristotle is he's utterly realistic. So he always says you need a share of health and a share of wealth and other accidental little things. You don't need huge shares of these, but you need semi-decent health. You need semi-decent wealth to be truly happy. Like, if you have the world's worst headache for the rest of your life, it doesn't matter how virtuous you are, you're not going to feel your eudaimonia, right?
Yeah.
If you're starving and you have a bellyache, you will not feel your happy. Aristotle always takes into account the bodily and the spiritual, the formal and the material. But he says the main share of whether or not a human being will be happy or not, getting it some from the tragedians that he's correcting, is what they have to control, what they can control. Sounds like an Alcoholics Anonymous tip or something. Yeah. Like, control what you can control in the moral realm. Get the moral virtues, right? Which is just, you know, the difference between excess and deficiency, and you have to habituate it by your intellect first. You get it into your will, then it's what we call second nature. You get those individual virtues, and that will make you mostly happy. Now, Plato, Aristotle's teacher, really wanted to find like a super virtue that would make it easy to get all the other ones.
Yes.
Like, I think we should talk about this some, because there's a lot of sort of, it seems like something that would make sense. And Aristotle talks about the virtue of justice, since it's one of our four cardinal virtues, as the greatest contender for this. Aristotle always challenged that. If the virtues, if there's a unity of the virtues, like one ring to rule them all, one ring to bind them, that get all the other virtues for you.
Which women would love. Wouldn't that be great?
It'd be amazing. Yeah, I mean, it would be easy.
You get that scratch off, you're like instantly virtuous in all categories.
Boom. Yeah,
I love it.
Like, done.
I love it.
I would love it too. You don't have to work. But think about it. We were talking about this beforehand, like, because neither of us wanted to be the kind of guy ever that was in grad school and was just a pencil neck, right? Because I didn't like guys like that. I knew a lot of them in grad school, knew a lot of them in law school. Yeah. And it's like, what we're really saying is, just to put it in terms everyone can understand, is you got to get the virtues one at a time. I was always naturally good at studying and things like that, even as a little kid. And I knew I'd be a scholar someday, but like, I always wanted to be good at sports. I always wanted to be a really virtuous man. I always wanted to be, good at making friends. These are all different virtues: courage, temperance. Yeah.
Nowadays, people refer to that as the Renaissance man. But back in the day, they called that being a virtuous man.
That's right. Right.
That you're firing on all cylinders. I think it's something particularly German, that everyone has this little specialty.
Right.
Right. There's 100 different pieces of the pie, and which piece are you? And I think the Greek way, the Aristotelian way, and the Thomistic way is, no, there is a call on your life to excel in the virtues, plural, and to fire on all cylinders. Like, right. We see that with Christ. He's the ideal man. He's the new Adam. And we see him, he's a carpenter. He's a teacher. He's prophetic. He's, of course, moral in every single way. Like, the divine, which is perfect in every way, there's a simplicity of divine, but there's a perfection in every way, comes through in his humanity.
Right. Like, think about what you just said. Christ, I'm sure, was a good carpenter. I don't imagine Jesus, like, cutting corners, no pun intended, right? Yeah, I'm sure he was good at what he did, because doing the small things well matters, right? But think about it. Think about it in your workout routine about whether or not there's a unity of the virtues. You said like four things I wanted to respond to there. Think about like those guys in the gym that just work out their upper body and never their legs. So they're like huge, and then they have these little like toothpick legs. The virtues are like that. You literally, you can work, spend all your time on one, but Plato desperately wanted to find a unity of the virtues that were like, oh, if I just work on my quads,
my whole body some guys will blow up.
The whole body will blow up. And people do argue this about the quads, by the way. Little workout tip. It's not true. You got to work everything out individually. Like you were saying, there are certain muscles that you work out and they greatly enhance your other workouts, right? Like that's kind of what the cardinal virtues are. Because Aristotle talks about more natural virtues than just these four.
He talks about the intellectual virtues. I mean, he's got a lot of virtues in the bag. We're focusing on the four cardinal virtues. Yeah.
And there's something to the idea that they're cardinal virtues.
They're cardinal. They hinge.
Right. And so you can make the case that they sort of open up the other ones. For instance, justice, Aristotle talks about in the sense he's like, well, there's general justice and particular justice. General justice isn't a virtue. It's just law abidingness, right? And if you live in a regime under a constitution that's basically good, that's more good than bad, then when you follow the laws will be helping you to pursue virtue. And so if you have a generally docile point of view with respect to good laws, that means you're generally docile to what's moral writ large, right? But he says there's also particular virtue. Particular justice is giving to each his share, which is why you shouldn't take more than you do, which is why socialism is wrong. We quoted this when we were talking about Leo the 13th. If I owe 20 to this employee and 10 to this employee, it's unjust to say, you know what, I owe 30 in total. I'm going to split the difference, give them each 15. I gave you 5 too much. That's unjust. I also gave you 5 too little. And nowadays we'd say, well, giving the one guy $5 too little is not good. But there's no injustice when you give a guy 5 too much. Aristotle and the older, more precise thinkers are like, no, you shouldn't be overpaying someone by $5, particularly not for some sense of equality, right? Equality always strikes against justice unless it happens to exist.
And that what you just said right there is 180 degrees against American discourse. Everyone right. believes that justice is equality.
Right, right.
If a kid on the team didn't score a goal, that's a problem.
Right.
If the high school had 10% that got Fs, there's an injustice in the school. That's right. People are now looking at outcomes, and if there's not outcome equality, they believe it's contrary to what they call social justice. We have these social justice warriors going around, and they're pointing at the underliers and saying, this proves injustice. That's because everyone's been taught to think wrongly.
Diametrically wrongly.
Justice does not mean equal outcomes.
Right, right. Can we talk about this for a sec? Like a minute and a half?
Sure, yeah.
So Aristotle calls basically what we consider egalitarianism, this miswired view that things should end up equally. He calls this arithmetic proportion, meaning everyone gets equal shares. He talks about true justice as what he calls geometric proportion. Geometric proportion is precisely what I said before. He says justice happens when we're honoring geometric proportion.
Yeah, because in geometry, you could have all triangles have 180 degrees. But you could have an enormous triangle or a little triangle, but they're still triangles.
Right.
That's how geometry works. There's ratio. Right. In mathematics, 2 + 2 is always 4. 5 + 5 is always 10. So
precisely.
That's what Aristotle's referring to.
He's saying give great amounts, great shares to the great. Give small shares to the small. If you owe this guy 20, give him 20. If you owe this guy 10, give him 10. This even figures into his lesser virtues like magnanimity. You know, you don't want the lesser man taking more share of honor than he's due. Also challenges this American Western European style of socialistic honor distribution, right? Oh, we want to honor the small guy. What were all the great Shakespeare's? What were all the Shakespeare plays about? It's great men, royals, right? The idea of let's tell a story about the everyday man is too much honor for the everyday man, would say Aristotle, would say Thomas Aquinas. So key to justice is rewiring the way that you think. The founding fathers thought like Aristotle. They're secretly reading Aristotle on the sly, and they would say, this is precisely right. And in Aristotle, it's precisely wrong in our modern discourse to talk about justice as egalitarianism. Aristotle says they're opposite. They all think about it this way. You're watching a basketball game, right? You want the game closely called. This is geometric proportion by a ref that's calling every exact thing so that you don't wind up with a tie. So you wind up with a disparity of outcome. That's a good game or football game or any sport. What's a bad game, what egalitarianism is refs who cheat for the weak side they're told fudge the rules, fudge everything to make sure that the score ends up a tie. It's the opposite of what we want. Yeah. It's the opposite of how you want society wired. That's specific justice, which is a virtue. Giving to each is due.
Now, what if someone says, you guys don't sound very Christian. That doesn't sound very Christian that there are greaters and lessers. Hey, look, this is how God runs reality, both on the natural level and the supernatural. There are angels that are better than us. They're smarter, they're faster, they're quicker, all that. I will never be an angel. I'm never going to reach that natural attainment that they have. God set it up that way, and God loves it. And so I accept it, and I rejoice in it. Same with salvation. God did not set up an equal outcome system. Some will go to hell. Some will go to purgatory and then go to heaven. Some will go straight to heaven based on performance. And Christ even says there will be greater punishment, greater reward, lesser reward. He records every man according to his deeds. It is geometric, literally, it is a ratio. I don't expect, and I do not demand that I get an equal treatment as the Blessed Virgin Mary Theotokos in heaven for eternity. If I make it to heaven, I'm not going to be like, well, how come she gets to sit at the right hand of Jesus and I
want to be queen?
Well, there's a lot of people in the church that want to be queen right now.
I know.
I think it should be equal. No, in fact, one of the most beautiful things in Dante's Paradise is that he says that everyone has the beatific vision. And so in that sense, they are kind of equal, but yet there's a hierarchy in heaven. There's a greater and there's a lesser. And poetically, I think Dante somewhat successfully illustrates that reality of everyone having immediate access to God, and yet there also being a hierarchy and a gradation, a geometric ratio in heaven. It's kind of a mystery, but we all need to just accept in order to be happy. You're going to be miserable if you don't accept this. God likes hierarchy. God likes gradation. He likes ratio. And there is not an equal outcome system. And if you try to make reality equal outcome, you will be a miserable social justice warrior. You will be miserable because you cannot bend reality to that ideal.
It's not
a man-made ideal.
It is man-made. It's not the way the Lord created nature. This is arguably the heart of today's SJWs, non serviam, right? Mm-hmm. They won't serve because nature made men and women unequal, right? Men are better athletes. Men are going to be, they're bigger, faster, stronger. The SJWs can't accept that. Certain men are much bigger, faster, stronger, smarter than other men.
Yeah. They can't even accept, well, if you kill a chicken, that's immoral because they're equal to us. No, they're not. They're ontologically different. Just like an angel is ontologically different from me. It being happy and being virtuous and being fulfilled and finding your meaning in this life is accepting reality. That's why I love Thomas Aquinas. He's the master of reality. It's not just a Black Sabbath album. Master of reality, right?
No, it's really, really important. That's why we're talking, but this goes back to what you were asking me to describe before, which I might have done insufficiently, inadequately. That's why studying nature, even the nitty-gritty studying habit, which is really Aristotle and Thomas didn't think it was glamorous, but they thought it was important, which we've said the Protestants and Protestantizing Catholics have kind of repudiated. That's why. Because you have to accept reality for how it is. And when we say reality, we mean nature, the way that God wired it. He wired it hierarchically. He wired it in such a way that habit matters. The only virtue that matters is not just prayer and fasting. That's higher. But first, you have to learn just to eat the proper amount at meals, to be a fatso.
In order to pray and a fast requires the virtues. Right. Not eating food for 24 hours requires, most people can't do that, surprisingly, because they have not been habituated for fortitude.
That's right.
Praying the rosary, most people can't pray the rosary every day for 365 days a year. Why? Because they haven't been habituated in the virtue of it. So even in the supernatural means attending Mass every Sunday, going to confession regularly, praying the rosary, reading the Bible every day, mental prayer, all of these things require habituation and virtue. So it's all wrapped up. It's all mingled together.
That's right. That's exactly right. Just to finish off justice, which is, the heart of the natural law, remember what Jesus says in the parable of the talents. He wants us each investing our talents, our amount. He gives different amounts to different people. I love this because it vindicates both aristocracy over egalitarianism, and it vindicates like market economy, right? He says it does it all at once with one little parable. He's God. That's how smart he is. Only man who ever walked the earth that's smarter than Aristotle and Thomas, by the way, I think is Jesus of Nazareth.
But well, I always say that Our Lady was the greatest philosopher theologian.
Yeah.
I'll put her above Aquinas. She just didn't write much.
Debate. Yeah, she wasn't a huge huge discourser. Yeah. Not discursive. But Jesus says you'll be given different amounts. Even if I gave you just a small amount, I still want you to invest it. If I give you a kind of common medium amount, like the fat part of the bell curve, I want you to invest it properly. If I gave you the most, I expect you to make the most money investing it, right? I expect you to take it and have it blossom the most. So the great Christian, I mean, Christ derivative endorsement of geometric proportion. It's excellent. Real quick, you said, just to hit a couple of the other cardinal virtues, prudence, you get to in book 6 of Aristotle. Prudence is the only, all the other virtues he talks about are what he calls the moral virtues, the virtues that you get the middling amount, the golden mean, and you'll be between the excess and the deficiency in a geometric way, by the way. For all the moral virtues, this is just an aside. It's also interesting. This is how important geometric proportion is. They're always the mean between excess and deficiency, but it's always closer to one side than the other, which is very interesting. So he says, even though rashness is too much of courage, cowardice is too little of it, courage is slanted toward rash. It's a little closer to rashness than cowardice because of geometric, what we're saying about geometric proportion. We're always dealing in geometric means rather than arithmetic. So you go through, you get all of these individual moral virtues, which even include things like magnificence, how to spend, magnanimity, right, how much share to take of honor, justice, temperance, all the ones he talks about in books 1 through 5. And then you get to book 6 and he's like, there's also intellectual virtues. I'm only going to talk about one of the intellectual virtues, says Aristotle in book 6. But he says it's prudence. And it's okay, you have all the virtues, you have all the habits habituated, but now you need to know in real time which virtue to draw from, like little canisters. Here's my courage, here's my, you know, friendliness, even amicability is a moral virtue. What should I draw from in this situation where this guy is challenging me to a fight? Should I draw from courage or should I draw from amicability? And the only way to know, says Aristotle, and says the Christian tradition, is having boots on the ground and having good prudence. So yep. Prudence is literally which virtue do I draw from and when, and they're all snap decisions.
Yeah, prudence is the DJ.
Right.
Yeah, he's running all that. There's another great video. I did an interview with a Dominican priest, Father Bradley Elliott. I'm going to put it in the top right corner. He and I go through all the intellectual virtues, of which one is prudence. We're looking at moral. So if you want to take it to the next level, check out that video in the right corner. You know, another cool thing about prudence or phronesis is in Dante. I love Dante. Go read the Divine Comedy. It's genius.
Excellent.
But he has the four virtues and they're wearing purple because they're natural and they're royal and they're regal. But leading the procession of the four virtues is prudence. And he has three eyes. He has an extra eye, like here, right? I don't know if it's right in the forehead, but he has three eyes. And that's because he's the leader and he's insightful. And so really, you know, it's not like there's a secret virtue or a unified virtue, but if there were one, it would be right. Prudence.
Right.
Because prudence is, so, you know, wisdom is understanding the universe and how everything works together in a general way. Prudence is looking at the universe, the cosmic order, and then making a very defined rational decision. For example, which minivan should I buy for my family?
Right.
I have this much money. what is the best deal I can get to bring the best outcome for my wife and my children for their safety and their transportation.
And in real time.
In real time.
You're making these decisions
And making that decision and bringing joy and fulfillment to the family with regard to that minivan decision. It's that basic, guys, is prudence.
Right.
Where should our kids go to school? Prudence. Who should I marry? Prudence. Which parish should I attend? Prudence. How often should I go to confession? Prudence. This is a habit. You have. If you're making bad decisions repeatedly, guess what? You don't have prudence. You make even worse decisions. My dad used to always tell me this. It's very philosophical. He said, success is thousands of good little decisions.
It's Aristotelian.
Who you hired for that job. You know, maybe you made that decision 6 years ago. But all those little decisions over time add up to great success. It's not just one thing you do and you become successful. It's thousands and thousands of little prudential judgments. And that's another thing that we've been ripped off on, people. We haven't been taught that.
No.
We've all been taught there's a scratch off and you get it and you win the big life prize. It's a lie. It takes you tens of thousands of little good decisions to become prudent.
Well, you were talking about this before. You said it's very German to consider anyone that tries to be an Aristotelian, well-rounded virtue ethics man, a Christian is what I call it, calls him, you know, like a polymath, you know, oh, he's trying to be good at our Renaissance man. It's like, that's also given to modernity through the poison pill of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, mm-hmm. to compartmentalize everything and to make everything and a
Kant,
separate
it comes
study.
From Kant too.
Yeah, all these guys who were influencing each other, Rousseau and Kant, they were and ended up influencing the American pragmatists like John Dewey, got very into this at the University of Chicago. Make everything a separate study, gender studies, which shouldn't even be any kind of study, you know, all and compartmentalize them and to take them out of the realm of these two intellectual virtues. We're not talking about wisdom, what it truly is, but they deprudentialized the study of, the studies of the academy writ large, and they de-wisdomized it too. But it's like, because this is key to being human. What is most key to being human, aside from our contingency, our thrownness, the fact that every challenge that will be thrown at anyone out there watching a video today, or you or me, will be thrown at us in real time. We're not going to get a warning. Like, you go to the store and just random crap happens, right? Yeah. I mean, literally, I'm in California. I need to get out. It's getting weirder and weirder here. A couple months ago, I was at the store with my family, nearly got in a fight with a wacko guy, you know, mm-hmm. and in the like soup aisle, you know, you're not expecting that. So again, do I draw from this virtue? I'm pretty good at this. This virtue I'm really good at. This virtue is kind of a weak point. Which one do I need to draw from in this situation, just for the best outcome? It's a function of prudence. And that's why it's one of the cardinal virtues. It's not the same thing as the moral virtues.
Yeah. You know, some especially college students have asked me, okay, so if I get really good at prudence, will the other three come up? Like, will I get them as well? Or if I get really good at justice, will the other three come up? And the answer is no, of course. Like you've been saying over and over, like, you can excel at one and not the others. But I use the analogy of buoys tied to a rope. And like, in the water, you have like four buoys tied to a rope, and the waves are moving. And so prudence could be higher, but it's never going to be where you're like 100% prudent and 0% temperate.
Right.
They do pull at each other and bring balance to your life. So it's not like, you know, it's not like you're going to be super extreme. But they aren't rigidly connected. So you're like, well, I'm just a very just person. You could still make really dumb decisions in your life because you're not prudent. Or you could be very timid and fearful. Even though you're prudential and you're just, you might just be a fearful person. Hopefully your spiritual director notices in the patterns of sin in your life, you need temperance or you need fortitude or whatever. Right. And by the way, here's another way you've all been ripped off in the confessional. Good priests that I've gone to will hear my confession and they'll say, you know what? Sounds like you're really short in fortitude and temperance and hope.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? And they're reading, and maybe we can switch to Thomas Aquinas here, Tim. They're reading the Summa Theologia. They're looking at the old manuals, and they're saying, huh, there's this constellation of sin in your life, Taylor, and that points to these two virtues in which you are low in. So since right now you're low in temperance, maybe you should think about fasting as a penance, right? Or if you're low in fortitude, every day I want you to do something you don't want to do. If it's call that person, that's right, write that letter, finish that chapter, that for the next 2 weeks, I want you to work on those daily fortitude exercises, right, of doing what you don't want to do. If a priest has never told you that, you've been ripped off.
Right.
The old way of training priests is they heard the confession and they said, okay, there's a constellation of sins here that are mapping on to these, or lack of these virtues. Let's write a prescription like a doctor and help this person out with that. I remember the first time I went to a confession, it was an FSSP priest, and he actually did this diagnosis for me, and I walked out of the confession like, oh my goodness, that's the most incredible thing ever.
Really?
Yeah, and it woke me up to thinking, I've been struggling with these sins, and they're not just detached. There is a pattern there, and there is a way I've been studying it in university and academy, virtues, and then seeing it actual to a practical application of sins in my life and trying to become a saint. I realize, wow, I've been ripped off.
Here's why you're right. And Aristotelians out there that just learned the sort of basic, oh, there's no unity of the virtues, and they're squirming in their chair. Why they're reading this all wrong? I mean, that of course is right. There's no super virtue, but your buoy theory is dead right. Here's why I think it is. It's because there's just like we talk about in the Bible. And then we're going to Thomas Aquinas. This is the perfect segue. Just like the concept of sevenness in the Bible is like completeness, the concept of fourness, particularly as it relates to the moral life, always, and particularly as it relates to Aristotle, always brings me back to the concept of causation, because there are these four causes, right?
Yes.
So the way that Aristotle's many moral virtues get distilled into Thomas Aquinas' account, which is more, which brings them up into the supernatural realm, is through fourness, right? Prudence, justice, which we talked about. Temperance and fortitude are almost more methodological, the other two remaining cardinal virtues. And think about it this way. There's always, in Aristotle and in nature, four kinds of causes for any given phenomenon. Anything that's happening, there's always a final cause, a goal. There's always a formal cause, what really makes the thing its intelligible self, its noble self. Always a material cause, the visible like presentation. And there's always an efficient cause, which is actually the work being done. Yeah. It's actually pushing it like an engine. Now, we're not talking about any one virtue in particular, but anyone who's striving after the virtuous life, which is supposed to be all men. Unfortunately, it isn't. So if we're talking about virtue writ large, which Aristotle doesn't generally want us to do, prudence is like the efficient cause, right? Prudence is actually what pushes you to make a decision for one of your virtues you've already gotten in real time, like we just talked about. Justice, I'm not talking about justice, the specific form or particular form, I'm talking about the general form, is like the final cause, right? The goal is, you know, that writ large rightness, recto ratio, a rightness of outcome is justice. So it's the final cause. This explains your buoy theory. I think this is the internal logic. Temperance is the formal cause, the way that all of the virtues work. How do they work? By selecting the middle, the golden right. mean. And that's what to be temperate is. Aristotle says you shouldn't be insensible. This is someone that never has fun, someone that gets mad at us for making a joke. We see it every time, you know, the prig or the stickler. Aristotle says this is too little fun. He calls a buffoon is too much fun, right? He even has a middling system, a system of temperance, which is usually, when he uses it specifically, it's for food and drink. But writ large applied to the system, I'm saying it's like the formal cause for virtue in general. it's you should be able the kind of person that can laugh some, right? You need to have a little bit of fun in your day-to-day life. You need to have a little bit of everything that's good, every virtue. And then fortitude, I think I know where you're going to want to go with this. Fortitude is almost like the material cause. It's a specific virtue, yes. I'm being un-Aristotelian in saying this. But it's almost like the material virtue that enables all the other virtues, right? Because let's say I want to get to be really, really good at, magnanimity. Well, I have to have the fortitude to persevere in even the habit formation. So literally, there's virtues that are cross-constitutive, and this these are the main four that, you know, prudence accounts for really what's efficiently happening. Justice is the goal, right?
Yeah.
The writ large form. Temperance is the way that it looks, right? Selecting the middle, the golden mean in every case. And fortitude is what you need to stick with the acquisition of any new virtue, not just courage itself.
Yeah.
So I like your buoy theory.
Yeah, I like it.
That's what it goes to say.
You know, another way to, and that's a really great outline of the four causes, another way to understand the four virtues is how it applies to the hierarchy of your soul and the four parts of your soul. And there's a whole lesson on this in New St. Thomas Institute, newstthomas.com, in which we do the structure of your soul and how it works. And hundreds of people have gone through that lesson and like, this is the best thing I've ever learned because I finally understand why I'm doing the things I do. How come I succeed and how come I fail? It's roughly this. You have an intellect, you have a will that decides things, and then you have passions. We might call them emotions. It's not really technically correct, but that's a way to understand it. And those emotions or passions divide up into irascible and concupiscible. Irascible is like your grit, your fight. It's like your chest. And your concupiscible is your desire. It's your lust. It's your sex. It's your hunger. It's your thirst. So that's the structure of your soul. And it needs to be in that order. Intellect, will, passions. Intellect, will, passions. And so prudence perfects, like you were saying, what chooses the mind. Justice perfects the will, giving to each, right? Fortitude perfects the irascible, the courage. And temperance perfects the concupiscible, your desires. I want to eat a whole pint of ice cream. I want to sit here and eat a bag of chips. No, temperance. And so Thomas Aquinas, when he arranges the four cardinal virtues, he sort of pins the tail on the donkey for each of those parts of your soul. The intellectual of prudence, the will of justice, the irascible passions, which are good when rightly ordered with fortitude, and then the concupiscible passions with the temperance. And you'll begin to see, as you excel in virtues in different ways, those parts of your souls are ordered correctly.
That's cool.
And that is called being a capital S saint. Right. That's what that sanctification and becoming a saint, the reason we have faith, hope, and charity perfects those lower virtues, which perfects who God made you with an intellect, will, and passions. Perfects you to become an ideal human. Saint.
Right.
And he loves that. That's the whole reason he made us.
Yeah, people might be out there thinking, how can the irascible like passions be good? I always go back to people, I think people are probably becoming accustomed to hearing me say this. Think of Robert Bellarmine saying not getting mad at the correct things to get mad at can actually be sinful and deeply disordered.
Mm-hmm.
Right? When you're willing to non-irascibly abide in justice. Yeah. Someone really innocent being picked on, a baby human.
Yeah.
That's really messed up.
Yeah. If your wife is getting raped, you better not be like, just stay cool, just stay calm. No.
Yeah.
That is not the virtuous thing to do in that moment. And so like the classic case is our Lord in the temple. He braids a cord, which signifies a measured, temperate kind of rage.
Right.
Think about braiding a rope. He didn't just grab something off the ground like a board and start beating people.
Braiding
the whip shows that he is intentionally preparing for a moment of expressed anger.
Whipping anger.
Yes. Yeah. And he's not going to go over and he's not going to go under. It's braided. Right. That's in the divine plan why it's a braided whip. And he doesn't just go into the temple and say, I've got a whip. He's whipping.
He's whipping people.
He's whipping it good in the temple. But, and he's turning over tables. There is physical violence and strength being exhibited, by the way, perfectly, 100% perfectly, by the eternal Logos, the incarnate Jesus Christ.
Right. And people, so how do the typical pastors with the watered down castrated homiletics deal with this story in John's gospel? They don't. They just leave it out that Jesus, they'll sometimes talk about the overturning of the money changers' tables. You will never hear, students are shocked to hear that Jesus actually fashioned a whip, which takes some effort, I imagine. I've never made a whip. And then he was using it on people.
Yeah.
So, and like you said, we know because Jesus is the ideal man, he's the God man, that everything he did was perfectly prudent, everything he did was perfectly temperate, perfect in every conceivable way, that this was proper. But isn't that really extreme? Well, it might be extreme compared to your culturally, you know, deballed expectations, but except it was perfect by definition. Anything else is pure heresy to say Jesus was off base there. I think it's really important you're saying that. The way you just put it is stark and good.
The God of Old Testament Israel was constantly scourging the people. Go back and read it. He's scourging the people. He's disciplining them. That's what discipline means, to whip, to scourge. So Jesus is, you know, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be. It's not like the Marcion heresy where God was really kind of mean and he was frustrated. He had anger issue problems until AD 33 and then he chilled out. That's a heresy.
Right.
It was Christ speaking from the burning bush to Moses. There's a Trinitarian element to who God is interacting with people in the Old Testament. That's what the Cappadocian fathers teach us. That's what the Greek fathers, all the fathers teach us. It is one God, as it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be. He does not change. And so we see Christ disciplining his people, particularly in a liturgical context, the temple.
That's good. I like that.
Can we say some things about Aquinas a little bit? I just want to bring it full circle here with Aquinas. So I'd encourage everybody to, I always say, read the Summa Theologiae of Thomas Aquinas. That's so hard. That's crazy. No, it's not. He wrote it for beginners. He says at the very beginning in the preface, I wrote this for beginners. Now, are there difficult parts in there? Do I get confused sometimes? Yes, absolutely. It's not a walk in the park. But you can do this. Again, if you go to newstthomas.com, we have in our philosophy curriculum, the whole first module, actually second module, is how to read the Summa, how to understand how Thomas Aquinas is speaking, how he arranges arguments. You spend 15 minutes in that, and it's like the key is turned, and you understand how to read all this stuff. The key part for what we're talking about today is the Summa Theologiae, second part of the second part. Basically, Thomas wrote a first part, a second part, and a third part, but the second part was so big it didn't fit in one book, so there's the second part A, second part B. We call it first part of the second part of the second part. A little bit confusing, but once you get it, you get it. And in that section, he goes over the virtues, the seven virtues. He begins with faith, hope, charity, and then he goes to prudence, justice, fortitude, and temperance. And along the way, he's basically quoting Aristotle the whole way, Nicomachean Ethics, what you've been talking about. But he's bringing about the supernatural. Aristotle didn't have faith, hope, and charity. And that's why Aristotle ultimately fails. It's great, but it doesn't get you all the way. It gets you pretty virtuous, but it doesn't get you to heaven. And so Thomas Aquinas calls this basically what Aristotle's teaching as the preambles of faith. It's like chapter one. If you're a guy like Aristotle and you're really smart and you observe natural law and ethics, you understand that there is a right and wrong, that there is virtue, that there is a God or a prime mover, that there are preternatural beings that help us like angels. There is an afterlife. So you can get that without a Bible. But if you want to get all the way and get to heaven and have remission of sins, you need things like baptism, Trinity, incarnation, etc. And so what Thomas is doing in the Summa is he's taking all the great nuggets, all the diamonds, all the gold from Aristotle, and he's saying, okay, Aristotle got to 89%. Let me get you the remaining 11%. Right. What'd you say?
Absolutely. I mean, and this is the discursive tradition. This is what Aristotle did to Plato.
Right.
I mean, Plato is the one that gave us the West, ontological dualism. He's the one that gave us matter and form. This is how you explain the fact that some things change, some things never change, which the pre-Platonics didn't understand. So the Aristotle just said, yes, there's matter and there's form, and here's how it works. Plato could never solve the most basic problems. You're standing on the shoulders of geniuses. In the case of Thomas, who works out the errors in Aristotle, he, unlike what Aristotle did to Plato, he's working out the errors with all of the boons of the graces, and he sacramentalizes it. He baptizes what's right in Aristotle, which is most, and he pulls out the wheat from the chaff when it comes to the errors in Aristotle. But Aristotle had done that to Plato. Plato had done it to Socrates. Socrates had even listened a great deal to the Pythagoreans in Greece. So there's this tradition. This is what we call scholarship.
Yep.
But Thomas ends up having the closest, basically the closest thing to just a perennial philosophy, right? Just a correct philosophy we can follow. So yeah, Thomas always gets all of our, yours, my, every Catholic philosopher, every right-minded philosopher, he gets the highest endorsement. People out there that probably know through Dr. Marshall, the new St. Thomas Institute, what's with this? I've had people come up to me like, why is it all about St. Thomas with you guys? You know, isn't it about Jesus? Like, it's definitely all about Jesus, but St. Thomas is the greatest scholar ever because he has the fewest errors ever. It's very basic. He studied the right people. You know, when he's studying the Bible, he's studying Augustine and Jerome and all the patristics, and he tends to, Thomas was super, super, super prudent. He pulled exactly what he needed to call from each individual source, and he knew exactly.
He's the ultimate DJ.
He's the ultimate DJ. That's really
what
he is.
You know, he can spin all these different tracks, and they all come together, and you're like, it's genius. I can't believe he pulled. Thomas was so genius, he would dictate six books at a time. So he'd be at a desk, and there'd be six scribes in front of him, and he'd say, okay, scribe A. And he would recite a paragraph for his commentary on Nicomachean Ethics. Scribe B, all right, here's a paragraph on commentary on Romans. Scribe C, here's a commentary on Dionysius the Areopagite. Scribe D, here's a commentary on Psalms. And he's literally writing six books at one time with one mind.
Stupid.
It's incredible.
It's so smart is stupid.
It's incredible. Now they called
him the dumb ox.
And they called him the dumb ox. And by the way, if you're in the St. Thomas Institute, once a month I have a special podcast called Ox Talk, and we just talk about that kind of stuff, dumb ox, Thomas Aquinas. One of the cool things, Tim, about what Thomas does here in the Secunda Secundae of the Summa Theologiae is he puts his finger on something that Aristotle did not, and that is Aristotle's basically Pelagian. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You need a little bit of wealth. You need a little bit of health, and you can make it. But the experience of humanity, this is where Aristotle kind of gets it wrong, is that no, we can't. We screw up. Some of us don't have the health. Some of us don't have the wealth. Some of us are born in really bad moral situations. You know, you're born on some Satanist commune. I don't know. You know, like you're not set up in, you know, Athens, 400 BC.
Right.
You know, maybe you're set up in Afghanistan. So what's missing is something supernatural, something that can elevate the virtues. And what we see in Catholic history are saints who are born in all kinds of situations, but through the gift of faith, hope, and charity, those other virtues receive a supernatural boost. What we'd call infused virtues. This actually does happen. Now, we don't all count on it. Like, if I just believe in Jesus, boom, I'm going to get 100% virtues. No, but we do see it sometimes. And Christ, in his wisdom and in his prudence, does use the supernatural deposit of grace with faith, hope, and love to give us boosts in these virtues. So you can see someone who was maybe, you know, a heroin addicted prostitute for 20 years. They come to Christ, they have a conversion, and 5 years later, they're just super prudent or super temperate. It right. doesn't make sense. Aristotle would not understand that supernatural hyper boost. I don't know what else to call yeah. it in a catchy way. But right. there is that element, and Thomas Aquinas, a great example from Thomas Aquinas is they wanted him to sleep with this prostitute, his parents. His mom and his yeah. brothers bring in the prostitute because he's yeah. just this overly religious guy. I'm like, hey, let's just get him a hooker and he'll chill out. And he gets a log from the fire and he chases her out of the room.
I know.
And then with the smoldering log, he puts a cross on the wall and he falls on his knees to worship Christ. And the angels put this cord around his waist. And he says never for the rest of his life did he ever struggle with the sin of impurity, sexual sin.
Great
In
story.
Other words, yeah. God gave him 100% temperance in that moment.
Right.
So right. that does happen. For most of us, in most of our life, God calls us to fight the fight. It's a battle. But, I mean, you want to add anything there on Aristotle? Did I dog Aristotle too hard there?
Not at all. I mean he's a pagan. He's the blessed pagan.
Yeah.
But he's the Stagirite.
Yep.
The philosopher, capital P for Thomas, but he's a pagan at the end of the day. He lives before the kind of grace that enables people to come by faith, hope, and charity. And yeah, so when I was saying there's no super virtues, one ring to rule them all, one ring to bind them, that's just with the natural moral right. virtues. But with faith, hope, and love, now you're operating on a post-Jesus plane mm-hmm. where that is possible. Look at the Cours des Arts. Look at St. John Vianney, who is not a smart, probably an IQ 80, right? Almost like a Forrest Gump. And look what he was able to do just through faith, hope, and love. You know, he couldn't even pass the boards to get into the priesthood. So no, that all breaks down once we take it to the Thomistic level. It goes to a higher level ontologically, and therefore the analysis even goes to a higher level. Now, the one thing we should just say is that's super interesting, and I know you've talked about it before, is what Saint Thomas had such amazing prudence to fight for his right to use Aristotle, right? At the University yeah. of Paris, where Albertus Magnus, he dragged him there, and this is like, just what an amazing time to be a student. You know, guys yep. like you and I would just, fantasize oh, yeah. about being
give
a
my,
student.
Give my left arm for that.
Yeah. To be at, you know, before it was the Sorbonne and was, you know, all studying stupid post-Enlightenment drivel, it was the University of Paris. And it's like, literally you had in dialogue, Muslim yep. Aristotelians, Jewish Aristotelians, Dominican Christians yep. who were Dominican Catholics who were Aristotelians. You had the Neoplatonists and the
Bonaventure
Franciscans.
Yeah.
Bonaventure. I mean, what an amazing time to be alive. And they, guys like Bonaventure were not in favor of bringing Aristotle into the church. And St. Thomas was so, he was such
He took heat. DJ. He took some heat.
He took some, well, got in big, big trouble.
Yeah, big right? trouble. Yeah, had to
for
leave.
Bringing Aristotle. Aristotle was on the index, right?
Yeah.
And St. Thomas was like, no, we need Aristotle. Because the scriptures are insufficient alone, obviously, but because there's so much gold here
yeah.
that explains in a superlative way how the natural virtues work. But he never said, part of his defense of Aristotle was Aristotle never tries to explain how the infused virtues work. He's ignorant of them utterly. Yeah. So no, you said everything perfect.
Yeah, Aristotle would reject that openly.
Yeah.
He would say, I don't understand how that would work, how the prime mover so far away would infuse justice into a person.
Right.
Doesn't make Why? Any sense. But no. If you have an incarnation and the eternal logos becomes man through the womb of the Virgin Mary, that is a possibility. That's what we believe right. as Catholics.
Right. I don't think Aristotle would have denied the possibility, but still he was just, I mean, he was reasoning to the idea as a non-Jew, he was reasoning to monotheism. That's impressive enough.
Yes.
Right. And disbelieving in the Greco-Roman gods, the Olympians. I mean, that's impressive right there. He was reasoning his way to what we know are the natural virtues that are Are they just Christian virtues? Well, yes, but also no, they're for everyone. He is reasoning his way without the scriptures to that. He never saw fit to make the connection between theology, between the incarnation and soteriology, right? That's just too far above his head for his place in time. He would have accepted it, though, because he accepted all things reasonable and good that were available to him.
Yeah, hopefully. Good. Let's do some home. Let's assign some homework, Tim.
Bless.
All right. So, I would say if you want to understand what Tim just said about, you know, the 1200s, Thomas Aquinas, Bonaventure, Aristotle, what's going on in Catholic theology? How did all of this happen? I have a free book for you. Click the little button in the top right of the corner. Thomas Aquinas in 50 pages. It gives you, you know, 10 pages of biography, 10 pages of his philosophy and theology, 10 pages of his writings and all that kind of stuff, and a dictionary in the back. It's free. It's simple. It'll get you up to speed really, really quick. Thomas Aquinas in 50 pages. By the way, if you sponsor this channel on Patreon, the links, and I'll send you a signed copy of that book physically. So check that link, Patreon.com/Dr. Taylor Marshall. What else is good? Would you recommend someone just saying, pick up the Nicomachean Ethics and read it?
Yeah, I was talking to a mutual friend through Patrick Coffin, and he was like, should I just pick up the Ethics? I'm like, it's so basic. The language is so straightforward that, again, it's not going to be like an enthralling read, like a pirate adventure novel, but it's basic. It's difficult and a little bit drier, not the same thing. The Ethics, kind of like reading Thomas, like reading the Summa, is eminently understandable. I always encourage the reading of Nicomachean Ethics. It's the most pre-Christian of ancient philosophy. It is far and away the most understandable and the most valuable, most private value for your life. Every fall, I run through this with the 12th graders. I promise them there's going to be more value, pound for pound, page for page, in Aristotle than any other thing they'll read, aside from maybe the Bible or St. Thomas, which I doubt they will ever get to, because I'm not forcing either of those two on them. And they sort of scoff, but they sort of know that I wouldn't say that. By this time of the year, by Thanksgiving, when we're mostly done with it, we go through all 10 books. They're like, that was amazing. It's just, yeah, literally even book 8's on friendship. Oh, just get into the Ethics. This is what I was saying to this mutual friend of mine and Pat Coffin's. Get into it. If you have any doubts, which you won't have many, he's pretty clear about what he means. And he's unpacking things that you preternaturally know. He's just unpacking the interior logic. Then you can find a commentary online in that rare case.
And I would say the best commentary on the Nicomachean Ethics is Thomas Aquinas's commentary on Aristotle's Ethics. It's a little bit harder, but you can do it. You can do it.
Yes.
I've one of my greatest joys in life is bringing so many people, young and adult, where they say, I thought I couldn't read Aristotle or Plato or Aquinas, and I started reading him. Thank you. For me, making the world a more Thomistic place and people just getting over the initial fear.
Right.
That's like my apostolate, if you want to call it. I just love it when people say, hey, I just finished the first book of Summa. Thank you. It is possible, people. I have people in New St. Thomas Institute who have read, laymen, who have read the entire Summa in a year. You can do it.
It's not, the thing is, the distinctions are helpful, right?
Right.
It's not, I wouldn't tell people that about reading Schleiermacher or Kant or Hegel or Feuerbach, but the good part is, this is how nature was designed. It's wrong philosophy anyway. It's hard and wrong. Right. It's the worst of both worlds. Aristotle and Thomas are the best of both worlds. They're easy, but they're not simple, right? I mean, compared to like German philosophy, French philosophy, right, it's really, really straightforward. It's not that hard.
It's based on nature.
So you already know these truths.
You already have a head start.
Right. And so it's true and it's relatively easy. And I'm not just saying that.
Yep.
Both Aristotle and Thomas get into the primary texts themselves. And the beautiful thing is, Yeah, it's amazing because you read Aristotle. It's not like other stuff where you need secondary literature. You just might want secondary literature, and then you can go and get Thomas's secondary literature. The only guy
win-win.
On earth up to the job. Yeah, it's a win-win because he cleans it up. It's like when I read scripture, which is not my strong point. It's not my forte. I'm not super well versed. I read Thomas's Catena Aurea, where he's already collected, best scholar of all time, in addition to like one of the smartest guys of all time. He's already collected all the patristics, like line by line, paragraph by paragraph. Just equip yourself with brass knuckles when you're already
gold,
strong.
Gold knuckles.
Gold knuckles. Aurea. Yeah, Catena.
Yeah.
Aurea.
That's what I tell people. They say, what's the best? I'm looking for a good biblical commentary on, name a book, Romans. And I say, Thomas Aquinas. Like, what? No, I mean like a modern one. I'm like, no, dude, go get Thomas's commentary. It's the best.
It's so clear. It's so clear.
For example, Thomas's commentary on the book of Hebrews is so amazing. I just want to cry every time I read it. It's so good.
Is it?
And the whole story. Well, so there's a story that Thomas Aquinas is, they heard men in Thomas's cell late at night. Right? We'll kind of get in like modern church history now. Like, why are there men late at night in the rectory of so-and-so priest? So they heard suspicious male voices in Thomas Aquinas's monastic cell. They reported it to the superior. The superior says, who are these men in your room late at night? And Thomas wouldn't answer. So he said, under obedience, who are the men in your room? And Thomas says, well, I'm writing my commentaries on the epistles. And so at night, Peter and Paul appear to me in apparition and explain the text.
Really?
Those are the voices you hear, Peter and Paul, myself. Yes.
Wow.
So
I didn't know that.
If that's a true story, and I think it is, that means Thomas Aquinas is writing commentaries on the epistles, that's, and he's got apostolic help.
Wow.
And you read them, and they're so good. So we need to make the world a more optimistic place.
Get did you that. Wait?
Yeah.
Did you know that at the Council of Trent, the only book they allowed up on the lectionary besides scriptures was Thomas Aquinas?
Yes, I knew that.
That's a council I like.
That's a council.
That's why we like all things
Trinity.
That's
why you and I are so Trinitacostal.
That's right, Trinitacostal.
Okay, right. Great. So get my free book, Thomas Aquinas, 50 Pages. If you want a signed version, support the channel on Patreon. If you want to take a class in Thomistic Studies, newstthomas.com. And then, as Tim says, pick up a copy. Just get a copy. Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle. You got to have one in your house. Put it on your nightstand. Maybe just the good vibes will get to you. Right?
Right.
And get the Summa Theologiae. If you don't know which one to get, again, we have guidance in New St. Thomas Institute on how to get the Summa, which one to read. And get deep. I want to go back to what we said at the very beginning before we close off, and that is, you have been ripped off. It's not your fault. You have been ripped off intellectually. If you're under the age of 70, 80, even if you're under the age of 100, so it's pretty much all of us, we were not rightly taught, not only catechesis about the Catholic faith, which we were ripped off on, but also just basic human knowledge, logic, rhetoric, tragedy, literature, ethics. How many of us received a good ethics class where we learned anything that we talked about today? Nobody.
My students.
Yeah.
And only them,
if
not
Tim's
me.
Students are watching, or some of my old students are watching, maybe them, but yeah, it's very rare. It's very rare. And the good news is you can order it on Amazon.com today. You can get what you need, start to read it. It's not that hard, and it will change your life forever. Being a saint will be easier.
Get over your allergic response to saying, I went to Catholic school K through 12, so I know that. You don't.
Remember
what Archbishop Sheen said about Catholic education. It's under attack. We should really do a show on this.
We should.
It's been under attack for this whole time, which is what caused, in a causal sense, that's the explanation for what you just said. I had it too. I actually left after 10th grade. Basketball conflicts with
which
the
is why you're okay. That saved you.
Which is why, yeah 2 years. But yeah, exactly. But I mean, we're all bastard children of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment set out to ruin education, and it did its work well.
Yep, absolutely. Okay, so that's your homework, folks. Thanks for watching. God bless. Check out all the links in the description below this video. And if you're listening on, if you're listening on iTunes, some of us, I've been hearing all the people that listen to iTunes, they're not seeing the video. They don't even know what you look like, Tim. to just listen to the audio. So if you're listening to the audio, thank you. If you're on iTunes, please subscribe and write us a review. I love to read the reviews on iTunes. So go on to iTunes, write a review. Really appreciate that. That would be awesome. Of course, if you're watching it on YouTube, which is a lot of people as well, go ahead and hit the subscribe button, hit the bell. That'll notify you for future videos. Till next time, be the Maccabee, be virtuous, excel in virtues, be intentional. Tim, last word to you. Go.
Yeah, in this case, be virtuous even until next time and even thereafter. Yeah.
Habitually speaking. Yeah, good.
All right. Habitually speaking. Yeah.
Signing off. God bless everyone.